I surrendered to the way things are. Rather than how I wanted them to be. So this morning, the house wren joined us. First chanting session with the house wren. There's one that seems to live right in the next to the little cottage I stay in, along with the yellow-bellied sapsucker, the brown-headed cowbird, and various other ones. There were 10. I can't remember them all. Isn't it amazing? Like, we don't even know this is happening right around us, but the birds are coming north. They're migrating, and they're here, and they're part of our sangha. And even though I didn't even see them, I just delighted in knowing that they were there. What brave beings. I couldn't migrate like that. So I'm going to start with a poem. I love this poem, and I'm always trying to find reasons to read it, because I'm not sure other people get it like I do. But we're going to try, because I love it so much. It's from a poem called The News. It's a part of the poem from a book by Tony Hoagland, a poet, Tony Hoagland, the title of which is What Narcissism Means to Me. I just like that part. That's good enough, right? This year, it seems like everyone is getting tattoos. Sharks and Chinese characters, hummingbirds and musical notes. But the tattoo I would like to get is of a fist and a rose. But I can't tell you how they will fit together on my shoulder. If the rose is inside the fist, it will be crushed or hidden. If the fist is closed, as a fist by definition is, it cannot reach out and touch the rose. Yet the only tattoo I want is of a fist and a rose together. Fist that helps you survive. Rose without region, without which you have no reason to. This is our human predicament. The fist, the protection, right, that we crave, the protected heart, and the rose, this magnificent world that we want to be able to connect with, belong in, be touched by. How do we have the fist and the rose together? The lament, yet the only tattoo I want is of a fist and a rose together. But I can't tell you how that could work out. So on a retreat, we see our primary strategies for dealing with living in this wild, unpredictable world of change. You know, the fire alarm's just one example, right, of how unpredictable this world is and how really so much is not within our control. We're going about minding our own business, and then suddenly there's these sirens blaring. It's such a wild world. And Greg talked the other day about our primary strategy that we try to use to deal with this world is to control it. the fist. That's our attempts to control the world. And it takes three primary manifestations, this control: grasping, aversion, and delusion. Our three friends that if you hang around Buddhism for long, you hear about as the three roots of suffering. So our attempts to control this world, to feel protected, have roots in why we suffer. It's a little bit of a predicament. I call greed, hatred, and delusion the ways that we protect the heart. You know, they're traditionally called defilements, but you hear that word and then we're just like, oh, yeah, I don't want these, I'm going to fight these. But there actually are attempts to have some sense of control in the world, and that's a poignant thing, really. It's poignant, our wish to feel some protection. We hope if we want something enough that we can keep what is important and dear to us, and we hope that if we hate something enough, we can get rid of it and not have to suffer it. And with delusion, we hope that if we space out enough, we won't really feel too much in this world. So it's a lot of micromanaging to try to get reality to conform to our wishes. But the painful predicament of our human life is that the more we try to control life, the more we suffer from restlessness, frustration, stress, and dissatisfaction. And the more bound up, self-absorbed our heart-mind becomes, and we miss out on the rose, on intimacy with this magnificent world that we live in. So on the spiritual path, we slowly transform the heart and the mind from taking refuge in greed, aversion, and delusion, these control protective strategies. We slowly transform from taking these strategies as our refuge to manage the world and develop wholesome and beautiful ways that the heart can feel, you could say, protected and still be in touch with the world. Love and wisdom are our primary wholesome protections that we develop. And as we let go of the contraction of greed and aversion, as we let go, the heart has space to open and to widen, disentangle, and be here. There it is, our own inner Wyoming. Or you could say the mind does all those things, or the mind-heart does all those things. So we develop ways to be strong enough to have an open heart in this wild world. We cultivate the wisdom and equanimity and love and compassion in our hearts that are strong enough to melt the ice mountains, the contracted protections of greed, aversion, and delusion. So we nourish all kinds of wholesome states of mind. And there's many lists of them. There's the seven factors of awakening that includes mindfulness and energy, investigation, joyous interest, tranquility, calm, equanimity. There's the four Brahma-viharas, metta, compassion, appreciative joy and equanimity. There's the four spiritual powers, faith and concentration and wisdom and effort and mindfulness. There's a lot of just beautiful qualities that are developed. Oh, and the 10 paramis. I didn't even get to the 10 paramis, right? Generosity, ethics, patience, truthfulness, kindness. And the truth is you're developing all of these here. You're just not quite noticing it. Or you're developing different ones. We tend to kind of notice what's going wrong, but we forget that we're actually developing patience and kindness and equanimity and metta So all of these qualities strengthen and protect the heart and mind. Greg was talking yesterday about contentment, right? Wholesome mind state. The first moment he remembered feeling that. It's so interesting because I sat there and I was like, oh yeah, I remember the first time here I felt joy. I was washing the dishes. I was washing pots. And it was winter and I was looking out the window and it snowed the night before and there was sun on the snow. I felt so happy. I started to cry. There were tears running down my cheek. I was like, I've never been this happy in my entire life. It was so astonishing to me, right? So today I want to talk about metta and equanimity, but wow, I'm not going to have time to talk about both as honest truth, so I have to figure out what to do here. I'm going to have to be in touch with the way things are, and I'm going to jettison the whole metta part. It's the only way it's going to work. It's hard. I have to let go. There's so much I want to say, but we've talked about metta some in the evenings, and yeah. But anyway, just the short version of the metta part is that metta protects our hearts. In Burma, it's called a guardian meditation. A protection meditation. And it protects our hearts because of its unconditional quality when it's supported by equanimity, that it's completely inclusive. There's nothing left out. So what's there to be afraid of? Right, so metta, when our hearts are strong in metta, I'm going to talk about metta a little bit. When our hearts are strong in metta, there's such a beautiful place to live, like to live with that heart. And then it influences how we see the world. So we see the world through eyes of benevolence. That's a real protection. It kind of changes how everything looks. And so metta kind of dissolves greed and aversion. That's part of its job. And then as it does that, we get more in contact with this world, and the world gets more alive. Everything becomes alive. House rents become our friends. Everything and everyone becomes our friend. Now, I know that sounds high and lofty and unattainable, but little by little, we stretch the capacity of our hearts to not harbor ill will against any being. Okay, I'm going to do it. There, I did it. Equanimity. Ooh, equanimity is such a great quality. And again, it has the same greatness as its inclusivity. Equanimity is the heart and the mind that are that can be made poised and balanced and graceful in this world of change, the ups and downs. Pains and pleasures, joys and sorrows. I think of it as a quality of great poise and dignity. We let go, again, of grasping and aversion, attachment and aversion, and rest in the truth of how things are now. You could say that equanimity gives up magical thinking of an improved reality. And lands fully here. It makes me think of a story that happened when I was in Burma one time. So I did practice in Burma a number of years, and when we go there, we had our own little huts. They're called kutis. And one day I was comparing my kuti with a friend of mine, we were comparing, and I think each of us were hoping secretly that our kuti was better than the other one. So my kuti was smoky, smoke from the village. It was noisy, and it was hot. Yet, it didn't have many bugs, and it had an amazing view of the Irrawaddy River Valley. Her hut was quiet and cool. The air was cleaner, yet it had bugs, mosquitoes, even a snake. And it was stuck back in this narrow grotto with no view at all. We concluded that there is no perfect kuti. And that phrase, ever since then, has been my shorthand for giving up the expectation that there is some perfect circumstance that I can create and that will solve my problems. And remember to just land here. There is no perfect kuti. We haven't been withholding the instructions on how to find the perfect kuti. So with equanimity, what we're practicing is we're practicing the ability to relax the fist, to relax the grasping and the aversion and to land fully here. And it doesn't come easy, right? But we can practice with small challenges that come up, like a headache. We might not like having a headache, but that's our reality right now. We might hate the headache, wish we didn't have a headache, but the truth is that right now we have a headache. And so we end our, you could say equanimity is ending our argument with reality. We end our argument with reality by settling into the truth that there is right now, a headache, and relaxing the opposition to the way things are. And yes, please take a pain reliever. You get to do that. It doesn't mean we have to be stoic. Letting go in that way doesn't mean that we don't respond. We still act skillfully from wisdom. So when we talk about letting go in Buddhism, what are we letting go of? We're letting go of attachment. We're not letting go of things or experiences. They're moving on fine by themselves. We're letting go of the fist. Or you could say that letting be is a more appropriate term. And it's really a momentary thing. Moment by moment, we have this opportunity to rest. It's a rest. Equanimity is rest. To rest in the moment as it is. I remember one retreat I was teaching, and one woman rose her hand. She just said, "Where can we rest?" You know, like that's a deep yearning in the heart. Equanimity offers rest. And it doesn't come easy because we don't accommodate. So another way you could talk about equanimity is accommodating change. And we don't do that so easy. So usually what happens when something changes is that, first of all, we deny it. I think of flying and flight cancellations as a huge, great place to practice equanimity. As a teacher, I fly a fair amount, and God, these days, right? So several times I've had trouble in Chicago, and I'll take the last flight home from the West Coast, which means you have to go through Chicago and take the last flight. So I get off the plane, go to the board, and then cancel. And I watch my mind. It'd be so interesting. The first thing would be, no, it's not true. Yeah, and then so look again, canceled. No. Look, I get canceled. And then aversion sets in. No, why do they do this? You know, all the forms of... So then there's some aversion. And then eventually the heart works its way to, oh, this is the way things are right now. But often we go through a few stages first. And we just let the heart find its way. One time I was flying from Bangkok, from Yangon to Bangkok. I had just been on retreat for a few weeks, and I was flying to Bangkok to do a program, that an English-speaking program that night. And so I get to the airport, and I hand my passport. The attendant kind of looks at it, gets this puzzled look on her face. And then she asks for my itinerary, so I give it to her, and then she looks at me and she says, "That flight was yesterday." And my mindfulness was really strong, so I watched my mind. It went, not true, not true, don't like, don't like. What do I do next? It took like, 3 seconds to get to equanimity because the mindfulness was strong. But it was so fascinating. I just find that fascinating. Not true, not true. Yes, it's true. So we hope that we can make ourselves let go, right? We try that, like, just let go. And there's an interesting quote from Ajahn Chah. He said, being a monk is, or you could say a practitioner, being a monk is knowing about letting go, but being unable to do it 90% of the time. So if you've been like, putting the bar way up here, just let it drop. Rather, we let the heart have its experience. We let the heart feel its way to letting go. And we can just do that by anchoring in the body. We notice that the stories about how messed up the airlines are, that just fuels the reactivity, right? But if we just touch the heart, care for it, let it have its time, it works things out. So because letting go is a process, we learn to make peace with that process. And I say that radical equanimity is the capacity to be okay with not being okay, to not kind of demand of ourselves that we be spiritual, perfect spiritual practitioners who, of course, can just let go all the time. One time I was flying back from Portland, Oregon. I'd been traveling for 17 days. I was ready to fly home to my own bed, sleep there that night. And due to a number of things, I put my card in the machine and I was denied the flight. And I was very upset. It was the last flight of the day, and I was, my ride had left and I was stuck. And I was going to have to figure out where I was going to stay that night and fly the next day. And so as I was kind of upset about this, this little voice on my shoulder says, "Rebecca, you're a Dharma teacher. You should be doing better than this." And then another voice over here said, "Well, I'm not, and that's okay." And I was fine. I was fine with the process. I just took my time. I sat down. Every once in a while, I was angry, so I felt that. I was upset. I felt like the airlines hadn't been fair with me. The flight was full. I felt like I got bumped, because the flight was full. And every once in a while, I just checked in. I said, "Am I okay yet?" Nope. Still angry. And then finally, it was like, okay, yeah, I'm all right now. I'm ready to start thinking about my evening and, where I'm going to stay. And there was something very liberating about that, about really being okay with the fact that I wasn't okay. So we trust the heart. We learn to trust the heart's capacity to find its way in its own time. Here's a great story from Pema Chodron. This is from the Shambhala Sun in September 2013. Years back, I took a trip with my granddaughter, who was 6 years old at the time. It was such an embarrassing experience because she was being extremely difficult. She was saying no about everything, and I kept losing it with this little angel whom I adore. So I said, "Okay, Alexandria, this is between you and Grandma, right? You're not going to tell anybody what's going on. You know, all those pictures you've seen of Grandma on the front of books? Anyone you see carrying around one of those books, you do not tell them about this." The point is, when your cover is blown, it's embarrassing. When you practice meditation, getting your cover blown is just as embarrassing as it ever was, but you're glad to see where you're still stuck, because you would like to die with no more big surprises. On your deathbed, when you thought you were Saint whoever, you don't want to find out that the nurse completely pushes you over the wall with frustration and anger. Not only do you die angry at the nurse, but you die disillusioned with your whole being. So if you ask why we meditate, I would say it's so we can become more flexible and tolerant to the present moment. You could be irritated with the nurse when you're dying and say, you know, that's the way life is. You let it move through you. You can feel settled with that, and hopefully you even die laughing. It was just your luck to get this nurse. You can say, this is absurd. There it is, right? Equanimity. And the lightness that comes with equanimity, you can hear that, right? With equanimity, we stop taking ourselves so seriously. And we stop taking... I don't want to say we stop taking life seriously. That isn't it. We stop taking the ups and downs of life so seriously. And what we're growing is we're growing the space of our heart and mind that can accommodate the present moment. She said, so we become more tolerant of the present moment. So we have all these little annoyances of our life that let us learn about letting go. And we get a number of them every day. People don't do what we want them to do. Situations don't turn out the way we want them to turn out. We lose something. We have to deal with something we don't want to deal with. We don't get something we want. We have a headache. All the little annoyances can strengthen our capacity to let go and rest in the truth of things, rest in equanimity. And then the more difficult challenges, the bigger ones, like losing a loved one, a serious health diagnosis, climate change, racial violence, pandemic, these require even greater capacity. It takes longer to let go of the fist, and that's okay. One teacher, I'm not finding his name right here, but he said, everything I've let go of has claw marks all over it. And, you know, with the harder ones, that can be true. In times of great suffering, I sometimes just ask myself, what does equanimity mean here? Because it doesn't mean not caring, right? That's our worry, is that equanimity means that we no longer care about things. I ask myself this question a lot about climate change. Like, where's equanimity with that, right? I remember one time I was sitting, I have a favorite rock in the woods I like to sit on. It's my friend, the rock is my friend. And I was sitting there, and I was really feeling the woods. They are struggling. They're not as healthy as they were. And the birds, there were fewer birds. It was quiet, even though I listed 10 this morning. But at that point, it was quiet. And I felt so much grief. I did not feel equanimous. I felt so much grief about this world. And I let myself feel it. I let myself feel that. And then as I was in the middle of that, you could say the spirits of the land said, "We're still here. Love us as we are now." It was so, it was one of the deepest teachings I've had in the recent years. It was, "Love us as we are now." And I think of that as a really great equanimity phrase for this kind of combination of equanimity that cares, that's in touch with the world. What's it like to love whatever it is, to love it as it is now, not, you know, as I was wanting it to be as it was and not wanting it to be as it was going to be. And, you know, I had all that in the grief. And I realized that actually in some ways the grief had separated me from the love. And I was able to actually relax into the love. And without the resistance, the world had so much more possibility. So what we see is that when we have grasping and aversion, we shut down the world and possibility to a narrow band of what we can tolerate. But when we can let go of that and allow our hearts and our minds to open and to accommodate the truth of the way things are now, there's so much more possibility. It's a wider space for us to live in. You know, after another situation where I remember asking this question was after the murder of George Floyd. I asked myself the same question. I was like, what does equanimity mean in this situation, right? And the answer that I came to really is that equanimity meant letting my heart break. Being, I call it heartfelt equanimity. It's the willingness to be with this alive human heart, to respond to the world, to feel with the world, and then be okay that sometimes that means our heart's going to break. That's part of this openness. That's part of the rose, actually, is heartbreak. And it's really okay. And of course, then we respond. We do figure out, like I'm involved in a lot of anti-racism work here at IMS, and we do something. Equanimity. A lot of times people think like equanimity, we're saying it's passive. I think equanimity is not the ending point, it's the starting point. Like equanimity is ability to really fully land here. And then with a clearer, less obstructed heart and mind, we can see much better, like, what is appropriate? What does this situation call for? How do I want to respond? Oh, there's so many stories I could tell. This is one I love, and I just want to share it. A couple. Here's an equanimity story from a 3-year-old. A student shared this with me. Your Winnie the Pooh story, I told a Winnie the Pooh story. Your Winnie the Pooh story reminded me of what my daughter said when she was 3 or 4 years old. I gave her a coin when we were leaving the store to put in the small gumball machine. I told her to turn the knob and then asked her what color she wanted. Her reply, I want the color I get. So much wisdom. And so the journey, right? Equanimity is a journey. It's a journey of attuning to our relationship with change, our relationship with feeling tone. That's a real, I'll get back to that if I have time. We don't always go super gracefully. There are some claw marks. Here's a great story from Joseph Goldstein. In India, I was living in a little hut about 6 feet by 7 feet. It had a canvas flap instead of a door. I was sitting on my bed meditating, and a cat wandered in and plopped down on my lap. I took the cat and tossed it out the door. 10 seconds later, it was back on my lap. We got into a sort of dance, this cat and I. I tossed it out because I was trying to meditate to get enlightened. But the cat kept returning. Do you have your own cat? I was getting more and more irritated, more and more annoyed with the persistence of the cat. Finally, after about a half hour of coming in and tossing out, I had to surrender. There was nothing else to do. There was no way to block the door. I sat there. The cat came back in, and it got in my lap. But I did not do anything. I just let go. 30 seconds later, the cat got up and walked out. So sometimes we go like that. We throw the cat out a number of times. But what we see when we really finally can let go and land in the truth of this moment, there's room for change. There's room for things to evolve. And when we resist, we kind of make things more stuck, don't we? I'm sure you've noticed that. So as I said, what grows is the amount of space we have in our heart and mind. One Lama explained it. It was like going from living in a cramped garage to living in an airplane hangar. And that he had the same stuff, but yet how much does stuff get in the way in a small garage, and how much does it get in the way in a huge airplane hangar? So we still have our stuff. We don't, like, we still have our personalities and all. And yet the container is so large, there's room. We don't have to bump into ourselves so much. So that's what grows, that kind of space of the heart and mind that can accommodate to reality. When I was a child, my dad would rent movies, yes, real movies on reels, from the local library. They would let you check them out, and we would watch them as a family. I came from a big Catholic family. There were 10 of us. And almost every time my dad went to the library, I remember just begging him to rent my favorite movie. And this movie was The Rail Rotter, featuring Buster Keaton. Buster Keaton was a famous silent movie comedian, so that it was a silent movie. I should just say this movie might not be anything like what I remember, but the story follows this journey of an Englishman. He's reading an article about Canada on a bridge in London. You can see like Big Ben behind him. And then he jumps off the bridge and comes out on the coast of Canada, and he finds this old open-air railway motor car, right? One of those little motor cars. And he uses it to journey across Canada. And there's this little box in the middle of the car, and he takes everything he needs out of this box. And wild things happen to him, and he just sits there. He's like steady, poised, but responsive to whatever comes along. And then there's this doot-doot-de-doo background, like music track. And so he's tall. You know, he sits there tall and dignified. And then, like, when it rains, he opens up the box, takes out an umbrella. When it snows, he opens up the box, takes out this down coat, right, a big coat. When it's tea time, he opens it up, takes out his little tea service. And when he needs to sleep, he opens it up, takes out a pillow and a blanket and puts it down. And when the buffalo cross the track, he stops and just watches. And I just so love just his dignified responsiveness. There wasn't many other things that happened in the movie. And to me, it felt like equanimity. It's just ability to move through life and to respond. So the last thing I'll say is eventually we find that these two great protections of the heart, metta, love, all the forms of love, and equanimity, that they come together. That they... you could say the wisdom of equanimity is infused with metta, and the kindness of metta is infused with the wisdom of non-attachment, which we'll hear a little bit more about tonight. And they become, you could say, heartfelt equanimity. Deepa Ma was... someone once asked Deepa Ma whether they should be practicing mindfulness or loving kindness. And Deepa Ma answered, "From my experience, there is no difference. When you are fully loving, aren't you also mindful? When you are fully mindful, is that not also the essence of love?" I'll end with a short story from, this is from the Tricycle magazine, spring 2019. A book review by Douglas Pennick. It's a story about the Zen master Joshu Sasaki Roshi. A longtime student of Sasaki Roshi suddenly left for an Indian teacher far less well known. "What will happen to him?" asked a fellow student. "Oh," Roshi replied, "I don't think he'll find true love." I thought this was a remarkable formulation, but the person who told me the story said, "Oh, he says that sometimes when he means enlightenment." "True love?" "Yes." Let's sit for a minute. Again, if there's a tidbit or two that seems helpful, we can bookmark that and then let the rest of the words float away. Coming back to the simplicity, sitting, breathing, cultivating wisdom and love.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.